necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sean Blackman, here with Jackie Lukeman. And as always, we are your guide for connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Oh, yes, we're here. We're back. Top of the hour. It is Monday, December 12th, 2022. And, of course, in 20 minutes, you'll be able to give us a call by any means necessary to give us your thoughts, ideas, questions, or concerns about anything you've heard on the show today, anything at all relevant happening on this earth. We want to hear from you. But that's not the only way that folks can get in touch with us here on the show. And if you would, please, Jackie, let the folks know how they can holler at us.
That's right, Sean. There are so many ways for our allies, accomplices, and comrades, that's y'all, to reach out and touch us at by any means necessary. Here in Washington, D.C., you can do that at 3:20 p.m. Eastern Time by calling us at 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. But you can also listen to our shows at sputniknews.com/radio. Click on the plus sign and type in by any means necessary. You can also hear us on sputnik.mave. That's MAVE.digital. And you can listen live on your radio dial at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time each weekday. And we're streaming for your viewing pleasure on Rumble right now. That's rumble.com/C/BAM necessary. The chat is live. And remember, friends, at 3:20 p.m. Eastern today, you can call us at 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. But wherever you are in this world and however you do it, we want to hear from you.
We most certainly do. We most certainly do. And we're very happy to be joined for the hour today by Mr. James Early, former director of cultural heritage policy at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution and board member of the Institute for Policy Studies. Mr. Early, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be with you again.
Absolutely. And Mr. Early, we've been seeing some mass protest happening inside Peru following the detention of President Pedro Castillo, which some are sort of pointing to as a kind of legislative coup carried out by the country's right wing. And Castillo's vice president, Dina Boluarte, is currently serving as the new president, or sort of the interim president, if you will. And I'm just sort of wondering what you're making of all this at this point, Mr. Early. I mean, you know, on the show, we've been sort of following Castillo's presidency from sort of candidacy period up until this moment. And it seems that almost from the moment he got elected that there were sort of issues that were really facing his administration that seems like it maybe part of leading up to this point. And so what do you make of what we're seeing inside Peru at the moment? And what do you think it says about what's happening inside the country?
Well, we've seen these kind of parliamentary maneuvers before. I think fundamentally what it says is that there is a deep class divide in Peru, recognizing that Pedro Castillo and won the popular vote by only about 44,000 votes from a right-wing Keiko Fujimori, whose father was also a right-winger and can't recall if he's still in prison. We have these deep class divides, and it also says something about these bourgeois democratic elections in which, notwithstanding the fact that Pedro Castillo received the majority of votes and was voted in, he was really unable to set up an apparatus to deliver the kinds of policies that he had promised. And he also faced tremendous racism and classism, and the fact that he was from a rural community, traditional, where just a racist barrage against him. But the bigger question here is, how is it that the election of an individual then is overturned by a parliamentary coup? We saw it with Dilma Rousseff in Brazil. After Lula's second term, she followed him. We saw it first in Paraguay some decades ago now, a decade or so ago now. We see that attempt here in the United States of America just a few months ago, January, not quite a year ago. And so there's some deeper questions here that we have got to analyze, that it's not enough to bring just an individual to power. What kind of cabinet is brought? Is it reflective of the direction of the vote for president, or is it reflection of the sort of provincial elements of the country, and where, as in the case we will see soon in Brazil with the inauguration of Lula coming up this January 2023, that he does not hold the majority in the parliament, and so that a cross-class alliance has got to be set up. And while the ratings for Pedro Castillo were very low, those are the ratings of the Congress were even lower. So this is a crisis of the democratic system itself. What do we take away from it? We take away from it that the voters who vote in, particularly someone from another class who is promising to speak to the welfare of the majority of the marginalized and oppressed and citizens, particularly indigenous citizens in the case of Peru, that we've got to have a standing, organized citizens movement 24-7 that reinforces people's power and not just what happens in government structures. So these are some very general kinds of propositions. I'm still trying to read more and learn more in the particular case of Peru, but we've seen a similar event in other arenas, and I think we can anticipate that we will see more of these bourgeois corporate class oriented try to overturn the popular vote and the popular will through these parliamentary procedures.
You know, Mr. Early, what I think I find curious in this situation in Peru is that the left wing parties seem to have abandoned Castillo also after he decreed the temporary dissolution of Congress, which was kind of the thing that prompted all of this, called for fresh parliamentary elections in 9 months, and installed an emergency government to rule the country until the legislative powers were renewed. He called for the reorganization of the judiciary, the public ministry, you know, because of the, I suppose, because of the right wing elements within. But even in him doing those things, I guess, to recognize that the right wing would be a problem for him to be able to govern with them, which I'm not sure if that's the right way to handle that. I think I'm just recognizing that may have been why he tried to do things the way he did. Even the left wing Free Peru Party, which sponsored his presidential candidacy, rejected his actions and basically abandoned him. So I'm not sure what to make of that. And I'm wondering what you think about that particular aspect of this issue.
Well, my thoughts and reflections are purely speculative here, because I've not had time to do sufficient investigation. I have a more solid working thesis on this. But it does appear to me that Pedro Castillo was focused on as an individual and got himself isolated as an individual, not having roots in a cabinet or a party that could reinforce his policies by being his bridge directly with the organized working class people that voted him into the stewardship of governance. And so, once he stepped beyond the standard parliamentary procedures and collapsed Congress, that sort of seemed to me to have intensified his being isolated as an individual. Having said that, and having said it in a very speculative way, still the focus on an individual, this is one of the problems with progressive and left movements, is our tendency to focus on the individual and not on the state structure apparatus that individual is part of. Individuals really cannot and do not make change by themselves. They need a governance structure to fall in place behind that. And it's clear that Pedro Castillo did not have that, and the left parties do not seem to have sufficient influence and did not seem to rally around him soon enough. This just didn't come out of thin air. What has been percolating over the months, and what has been the relationship of the left parties with Pedro Castillo and those around him, is a are outstanding questions that I think we have to examine.
Definitely. And, you know, you're right, Mr. Early, when you talk about how we've seen this sort of thing before, definitely within Latin America. I feel like we've seen it play out in Brazil, in Bolivia, and I feel like we're seeing it play out in Argentina as well, as Vice President and former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner was recently sentenced to 6 years in prison and also disqualified from holding public office for life on charges of corruption and fraud. And so, I mean, it feels like a similar situation based on my understanding of it, in terms of basically the right wing of the country, the wealthy elements of the country going after a progressive leader. And, you know, I'm definitely curious, Mr. Early, how you're seeing the Argentina situation as well, particularly within the context, not just of what we know about Peru, but also with the backdrop of what some might consider a resurgent pink tide of progressive and left-leaning governments in the Latin America region.
Well, in the case of Argentina, I was just there a few years ago, and actually we were trying to meet with Cristina Kirchner. She had just come in from Cuba, where her daughter was being attended for a serious illness, and we were leaving a day or so later, and so we were unable to actually sit down with her. In the case of Argentina and in the case of Peru, one of the things that we see in the context of the powerful metaphor, the pink tide, but can be an obscuring metaphor at the same time, is that these are often alliances within government, so that the president of Argentina does not share the same ideological grounding as does Cristina and her former husband. Her husband, who was also former president. And so this is not really a consolidated progressive governance or consolidated left government, as in the case, let's say, of Cuba. Of course, that's a single-party state. Or in many ways, as in the case of Peru, and I mean, in the case of Venezuela, where there are multiple parties, but that there seems to be a lot of coherency between the structures of governance in terms of the presidency, in terms of elected officials throughout the various provinces within the parliamentary system, and within the military. And this is where we have to examine the metaphor of the pink tide, important as it is in its struggle against neoliberalism for trying to achieve more democracy for many of them in the context of the capitalist system. And for a few of them, trying to not only achieve more democracy and material development within the system, but also looking to defeat and overthrow that system when they plant the pole of socialism. So that the pink tide is a broad alliance of ideological policies against the most brutal aspects of neoliberalism. But they don't all share the ultimate goal or the ultimate immediate possibility of uprooting neoliberalism, as in the case of Petro, in recently elected along with his vice Colombian vice president Francia Márquez. Petro has stated that he is doing nothing that the U.S. is not aware of. Francia Márquez, in running for the vice presidency, came to the United States, met with the State Department. We see that Lula da Silva, who will be inaugurated the first week of January 2023. Will also come to Washington to sit down with Biden. That's not to come and bow down to Biden, but it is to suggest that the pink tide is really an interim step against the crudest aspects of neoliberal capitalism, and only in a few instances building bridges towards a radical socialist transformation. But the significance of the pink tide also is that in that spread of ideologies and political policies, both domestic, regional, and international, there is a lot of alliance of mutual benefit, as we would see with the community of Latin American and Caribbean nations. 99% of them are small neoliberal capitalist countries, but they line up in the inter-capitalist rivalry against Western Europe and the United States while maintaining relations with them, but looking for regional integration, in which Cuba is a major participant along with Nicaragua, along with Venezuela. So these are some of the complexities that we have to unravel in our analysis and our political education and our public engagement of what people are voting for, such that they don't get they're not deceived that somehow Pedro Castillo is going to be the total opposite of Fujimori and the capitalist system, or that Lula, who is a declared democratic socialist, is going to be the total opposite of capital in a country like Brazil, which is up around the eighth largest economy in the world or so, in which he had to build a broad alliance, including middle classes and some corporate interests who stood against Bolsonaro because Bolsonaro, like Donald Trump, is unpredictable and too intense to be the steward of governance that they can actually make a stable projected plan. So these are some of the complexities behind these terms and behind these individuals, which boils down to what is the correlation of forces that brings a particular stewardship in the name of a personality to state governance.
Yeah, and Mr. Earl, I'm also curious, just from a standpoint of analysis, because you mentioned in passing about how sometimes the this phrase or concept of the pink tide, as it's often termed, can obscure certain dynamics as well. I was hoping you could say more about that too.
Well, the pink tide is juxtaposed against the notion of a red tide, and a red tide would be a socialist / communist ideological outlook with and immediate intent to make a transformation of who owns the modes of production, to socialize the most important life-defining elements, food, clothing, shelter, education, health, to make sure that all people have full access to that, and limiting private enterprise to, in some instances, people have tried to abandon it, but in other instances, as we've seen in Vietnam, as we're seeing in Cuba, to adjust where there is a limited space for private initiative that does not gorge the public, does not take away from the public well-being. And so that the pink tide is really a sort of interim social democratic policy. And in its most formal ideological point would be democratic socialist. Now, in the case of Cuba, in the context of the pink tide of Latin America, as a socialist society, socialist governance system, one party, et cetera, they are part of that mix, but one has to be careful of looking for synonymity. They are not equal. They're not the same. There's a lot of different interplay. If you raise that to a larger level of the notion of multipolarity, in which the pink tide and South-South relations also plays a part, there is a tendency of a kind of bipolarism to say we juxtapose the pink tide against capitalism in its most rigid form. But then we fail to explain the president of China was just in Saudi Arabia with this bloody dictator, this little family clan that controls all this oil. How do we explain that contradiction? I think it's explainable. It means it's a complex world in which the correlation of forces is all not ever really neatly aligned of simply A and B. There's always these little strings of attachment here or there, and one has to make a daily calibration on where you really set your main path and how you live with some of these contradictions. So the pink tide is a very important development in representing social democratic policies, the welfare state, trying to uplift the poor and the marginalized. But far too often, these pink tide governments are not rooted in organized social movements staying agile and engaged rather than waiting for the delivery from the state, but actually holding the state accountable and participating in the policymaking and in the implementation of those policies. And therein, increasing the whole notion of people's power, not as some abstract romantic principle, but as a day-to-day practical movement where trade unions are really running factories and community people are really involved with security and public safety with the police, where they are involved in the military, not just as a professional force, but also as a citizen force. And so these, again, some of the complexities that I observed in the context of the significance of the pink dye, but to make sure that we don't overvalue where we are in the struggle against these really vulgar, deadly aspects of neoliberal capitalism run by the NATO powers in Western Europe, which are expanding into Latin America and the Caribbean on the continent of Africa. And, of course, with the behemoth of the United States bipartisan backing and the military backing, where that bipartisanship is seldom questioned. They might struggle with each other on other things here in the U.S. bipartisan system of Democrats and Republicans, but not so much as we've just seen that they just passed a huge military budget, adding $45 billion more than was requested. So these, again, are some of the complexities that I think we've got to be able to talk about and to engage everyday citizens such that they become active in making those same kinds of analysis and being able to negotiate these contradictions when they emerge.
Definitely. We're going to move to our first break of the hour on that note here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back. So please stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sean Blackman, here with Jackie Lukeman. And as always, we are your guide for connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. Phone lines now open, 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. Myself and Jackie Lukeman continue to be joined by Mr. James Early. And, you know, Mr. Early, I was thinking over the break because, you know, I appreciate how, you know, you're always keen to remind us about how, you know, democracy is this collective process and can only be sustained by a collective processes, and that we shouldn't fall into the trap of celebritizing individual leaders. And I was thinking about this in the U.S. context, particularly as the issue of Moore v. Harper, that case continues to be relevant here in the U.S. as we on the show continue to hold that, you know, this is part of a far right attempt to basically go after people's fundamental democratic rights. In this case, basically the issue of one person, one vote itself seemingly at stake, at least to some extent, with not a lot of response or fight back from the Democrats or the liberal wing of the ruling class. And so we're looking at a situation where, you know, if the far right gets its way, then we could be under threat of basically like a permanent like right wing government here in the United States, if these different bodies have the ability to have that kind of power over the vote when they take place. And so I'm just wondering how you sort of conceive of that kind of democratic project in a place like the United States, which is fundamentally undemocratic by its very nature and from the very root. And, you know, we point this out on the show all the time, is that, you know, from the very beginning, it was a very purposeful effort to ensure that, you know, real participatory democracy was not what governed the United States, and that instead it was basically the whims of the wealthy minority that would always rule. And so, you know, this may also be somewhat speculative, because it's certainly not a moment that we're in right now. But how do you see those kinds of principles at the very least being useful or relevant as we begin to think seriously about a new kind of society, a new system here in the U.S.?
Well, I think we have to start with where you concluded, and that is that we have to open up a broad and consistent public debate, again, public education discourse about the fact that democracy does not exist as it describes itself officially here in the United States. There is not a one person, one vote calculus that delivers stewardship either at local, state, or federal levels. There is the Electoral College, which is fundamentally a racist, historical, and contemporary tool. And there are within the dominant, the duopoly, the two-party system of Republicans and Democrats, There are these special electorates who, because of individual status that they inhabit within the governance structure, their votes outweigh that of the popular will. We see this resulting in a paralyzed, dysfunctional federal system in a particular that fights as though it was a basketball or a football game of which team will win. It is not a question of which policies will win, except for the right wing with the so-called with the liberals. They are just holding the status quo. And this is what Joe Biden was very clear about, a return to normal order. So if you turn on Joe Scarborough or MSNBC or CNN, NBC or ABC or any of these stations, what do you see? You see your traditional liberal Democratic pundits sitting next to moderate, so-called moderate Republicans who have left the party or who have been thrown out of the party, who are now band together to try to reestablish that duopoly dominance such that they will be the only two parties that will compete for the stewardship of government perennially at local, state, and federal levels. And in effect, we have a dictatorship of the duopoly. It's like a one party with two wings, if you will, who fights to oust Democratic, the social democratic policymakers, and certainly fight against any avowed democratic socialists. So in the case of the Republican move, it is really your right to establish and effect a sort of one party governance mechanism with this regards more formally the popular will. Right now, the Democrats will argue we can't get anything done because the Republicans stand in the way. And the Republicans' basic line is, let's get rid of these Democrats. They are socialists or communists. And so this is a tragicomedy that goes on, and the popular will is thwarted, not just that it's not recognized, but the life circumstances continue to deteriorate. We see the resurgence now of COVID. And of course, we know what it will reveal once again is that the most vulnerable people will be Black, brown, women, working class, LGBTQ, running the class race line through the LGBT category. The trade union line, again, running the race and gender horizontal profile through the trade unions, and we will see the same thing. So that then this question of democracy, that the discourse that goes on is we must protect the U.S.'s democratic system. It is important to protect the right and freedom and facilitation of people to express their will. But let us not deceive ourselves or continue to deceive ourselves that that will is being responded to in the content of democracy. That is, what are the policy issues that people can work with to improve their lives, to protect their lives, to reach for legitimate dreams? That's where the content of democracy question is not being discussed. And what is being discussed and we're being diverted into is this pro forma situation as though we are protecting something ultimately precious. And it has not ultimately precious in the sense that it does not deliver to the most to the historically most marginalized, oppressed, and exploited people, including those class sectors of the white community who, for reasons of delusion of skin color, and some of it is just socialized outright hatred. It is not biologically inbred. It's socialized. It's educated or miseducated, as we're seeing what's going on in the school systems, really turning away from any obvious underpinnings of history to really uphold this structure that continues to immiserate them with methamphetamine, addictions running across the country, a sign that people are unrooted, people whose lives are unstable. So we have to question the very nature of this democracy in addition to fighting against this new maneuver by Republicans, but not let Democrats become the stalwarts for the protection of these philosophical abstractions that continue to be paralyzed in the practical element of delivering. We can't. You look at the situation in California. Karen Bass is just declaring a state of emergency. I was out in Los Angeles recently. It is unbelievable when you walk downtown, not to mention in other areas of Los Angeles, to see the sort of human infestation, if you will, of people living on the sidewalk in camps, you know, just block after block after block. And then you've got these monumental state buildings, these glowing towers to the so-called development. And the contrast is right there. That is not democracy. The public policies are not being delivered. And so this is how I think we have to approach this, by really holding the Democrats accountable, that they are not the stalwarts to protect us from this Republican surge, that we have to have organized citizens demanding that democracy really be delivered in content. Let me stop on this point. That is that it is not a petition to the Democratic Party. It is organized citizens identifying, maturing, nurturing, and voting in the stewards of governance that are accountable to them, that they hold accountable. Right now, we have these professional politicians, and we, the people, we, the demos, the ordinary people with our quasha, with our power of ordinary people, are sidelined for voting for the sideshow as though we were going to a boxing match or something.
You know, Mr. Early, what do you say to people who would respond to everything you just said about, you know, needing to hold the Democrats accountable for what they don't do legislatively for the people who they keep telling have to vote for them to save us from the evil Republicans? What do you say to people who respond to you by saying, well, look, there are people like Marjorie Taylor Greene in Congress who are saying things like, if they organized January 6th, we would have won, meaning, you know, the Trumpers would have won and they would have gotten what they wanted. And they point to, you know, the Republican extremists, the extremists in the GOP, the Trumpers in the GOP, which that's what the GOP is now, as proof that the problem is not the Democrats. We need to not focus on the Democrats. We really need to do something about those other guys.
Here's the issue. We're talking about a question of power. When I say politics, I mean power. The power to improve one's lives, one to protect one's life, to envision new possibilities, to allot public resources in projects in collaboration with everyday citizens to do that. Neither one of these parties deliver to us, but in their tactical difference, which is almost is raised to a level of strategy around their common upholding of this system, there are these spaces that we have to recognize. And that is, there are certain policies that people have been able to push for, that is, citizens have been able to push for. The way that it comes out and is propagated is that an individual congresswoman or congressperson did it. But no, organized citizens did it. I often use the example of the Democratic Socialist, most recently Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders did not build a movement. He intersected organized movement. Those nurses, those trade unions were already there. We've seen new developments like the Working People's Working Families Party and the like. But there are existing organized citizens movements that have been fighting in sectoral areas, areas for women's rights, LGBTQ rights, anti-racism rights, health rights. How do we draw the horizontal line, the node of nodes, the network of networks, to build an integrated force? Some of that may be reflected in a new party, but initially it's reflected in citizens looking to their right and their left and saying, yes, I share those same objectives, although I'm focused on this particular sector. How do we identify people that we vote to be stewards of governance? Because 340-some-odd million people divided in half, when you look at half the voters are voting for right-wing stuff for various reasons and the other half for relatively progressive arenas, you cannot run the country as individuals. You do need an apparatus, the state apparatus, and you need capable stewards of governance to do that. And so this is what I say to those folks, is that we have to get in the fight, not just describe the fight. And yes, the Democratic Party is not our ally, but in its battle with the Republican Party, we have to find those spaces in the governance structure where we can force onto the agenda the things that will help us improve our lives and strengthen our ability to, at some point, trump, if you will, transition both of these duopoly parties, which are not set up in the interests of the masses of ordinary citizens.
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, sort of sticking with this idea that this building of radical popular democracy, this participatory democracy, and how we've seen that develop over the world, but specifically within parts of Latin America in different ways. Recently, Venezuela marked its a day of loyalty and love for Hugo Chavez. And of course, Chavez was, you know, a beloved and admired leader, but he is also someone who would stress this collective nature of a democracy within the specific context of Venezuela's Bolivarian Revolution, and someone who often emphasized the importance of the communes. And so I'm wondering, how do you see that sort of playing out within the Venezuelan context? And how do we situate someone like a Hugo Chavez, who is an individual, but who really only existed in that way because of the efforts and support of the masses of his countrymen?
Well, as much as I have in recent occasions on this program and other programs I've done, steered people towards emphasizing the importance of social movements, social organizations, trade unions, sector-specific groups uniting with one another, I don't want to dismiss the role of the individual, because the role of the individual in history and certainly in current circumstances in different instances is very important. The role of the individual runs across the spectrum from the far right to the left, so that Mussolini and Hitler were extraordinarily powerful, compelling individuals in the public space to convince people to do some of the most horrendous things that we've seen in human history, the Holocaust being one of those issues among others. In the case of Mandela, who's not to be confused with the case of a Fidel Castro, we see our Indira Gandhi. We see, again, the role of strong individuals in relationship to organized movements. Therein, setting up these people power governance kinds of situations in communes and others, I think it's an important principle. But here's the problem that we're wanting to do: how to get that to a level of scale, how to get government resources and government expertise to really build that at some level of scale. And here are some of the objective contradictions to be faced, including that Hugo Chavez had to face. Venezuela sits on the largest oil resources, as far as we know, in the world. Under Hugo Chavez, who did some extraordinary things in building regional institutions like UNASUR, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations, the production of massive numbers of doctors that he and Fidel Castro set out through the Latin American Medical School in Los Baños, just outside of Havana in Cuba, but could not get off oil. We see no evidence where when oil was being filled, it was $100 a barrel or more. We see little evidence of where that surplus was being put in large-scale solar. So we find ourselves still tethered to extractive industries. The case of Evo Morales
Bolivia.
Bolivia.
Yeah.
One of the here's the Native American president, socialist, socialist party, a governance structure that did survive him, the individual, that did survive the coup and did inherit the state. But one of the immediate contradictions that he ran into with the progressive indigenous population was maintaining these extractive industries. These are difficult questions. They're easily ideologically to say, let's just take over the mode of production and move to something else. But in the practical arena, they are very complex and very difficult. So I've heard a lot about, you know, the local development and food stuff, the communities providing wholesome food in Detroit and Oakland and other areas. These are important developments that signal where the future must go. But we have to be able to get the collective resources, which generally reside in the local, the state, and the federal state budgets, we have to get them out to levels of scale to involve many, many more people. And in the case of Venezuela, you know, there's a big and interesting and I think important debate that goes on with the Communist Party of Venezuela in relationship to the Maduro's Socialist Party, which was really set up by the late president, Hugo Chavez, of arguing about these issues, about how workers are being treated, about how communes are being developed. So, yes, that is a direction, but we have to get it to level of scale. That the people's power is institutionalized. It's not just an abstract ideological, romantic kind of view, but it has instrumentation behind it.
Definitely. We're going to move to another quick break on that note here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back, so please stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sean Blackman, here with Jackie Lukman. And as always, we are your guide for connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. My dear friends, phone lines are still open. 202-521-1320. That's 202-521-1320. I am here. Jackie Lukman is here. Mr. James Early is here. And Mr. Early, I was looking at reports about some conversations that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has been having with different governments, namely the United States with President Joe Biden, Emmanuel Macron of France, and Recep Erdogan of Turkey, of course. And now they've been, in contact before, but reportedly these latest slew of conversations have taken place over a single day. And he was quoted saying, "We are constantly working with our partners." And he added that he expects some, quote, important results in the coming week around a number of events that have to do, of course, with the ongoing war in Ukraine. Now, it's not clear on just what that means or what the substance of these meetings really were. But I mean, it does seem that we've reached a serious point in the Ukraine conflict as things continue to escalate. And it seems the more time goes on, the more dangerous the situation becomes, not just for the countries involved, but for the whole world. I mean, I'm sure people remember a couple weeks ago when that those missiles struck Poland, killing two people. And it was asserted both in on platforms in the mainstream media and by Zelensky himself that those were, in fact, Russian missiles, even though Ukrainian government officials and even Joe Biden himself basically pointed to how it wasn't really clear what the origins of those missiles were just yet. And I'm wondering how you're considering the conflict at this point, because I don't think it can be overstated the dangerous potential of an open conflict between the nuclear powers of the United States and Russia. I mean, it's somewhat of a relief, at least for me, to know that there are people within the Biden administration who are advocating for negotiations. Now, what will ultimately happen, I think, remains to be seen, but just wondering how you're considering it.
Well, I think what we are witnessing is that the Western Europe and the United States and Australia and Japan have put a lot of their marbles on the table in Ukraine. And they would argue from this vantage point that they wouldn't quite argue stalemate. They all want to argue that Ukraine is winning. But let's assume, for sake of argument, that Ukraine is winning, but at what cost? Of a totally destroyed country that will still be balkanized by Russian-speaking populations, that the only way that they would have to impose governance over those populations rather than to recognize perhaps some element of national minority rights, and those countries are now aligned juridically. Whether one believes in what the referendum was or not, they are tied to Russia, as is Crimea. And so that these are things that now we're beginning to hear some people in the West say, well, there's going to have to be a negotiated settlement because this could bring us closer to a nuclear conflict. At the same time, playing this game of chicken in Poland, for example, sitting right on the Russian border a new military, the U.S. military base is going up. So there's still this game of chicken being played. But there's a bigger circle of political global engagement that's going on that they really want to give attention to, dating back more formally, that's now in the Obama administration, of turning their eyes to the Pacific, which means China. And so that while they're going down this rabbit hole in Ukraine, billions and billions of dollars exhausting their military hardware, both here in the United States and in Western Europe, putting that in the Ukraine, seeing winter come about, seeing this fluctuation in oil prices, we don't know what's going to happen with this cap on Russian oil. And as I was watching today, the price of oil has dropped. But there are a lot of imaginations that they put on the table, and they've concentrated into this one area of the world, including it's a breadbasket of the world. So it's having a waterbed wave effect negatively, particularly to southern countries, African countries in particular. And so I think now they have to really figure out how to recalibrate such that they can give some of this attention that they want to give to China. You know, the Canadians have just put billions of dollars into setting up military operations in the Pacific on some of these islands. The Australians are going full bore on China. So they're really concentrated right now in Ukraine in a way that is making a lot of Western Europe hollow. We here see the Germans walking slightly sideways as they watch the president of China move around the globe just in Saudi Arabia. You know, a very contradictory situation with Saudi Arabia, but in the real politics, this is one of these contradictions that you have to figure out how much value to give it versus the positive role of China and the self-determination and sovereignty and independence in Latin America as its largest or second largest trading partner, the flexibility that they're dealing with African countries and building infrastructure in contrast to the exploitive debt ways that the U.S. is moving. The rise of the Caribbean, via Motley Moore and Barbados, taking on the Bretton Woods institutions again, which taking up the historical mantle of Fidel Castro, who was talking about debt, you know, two decades or more before anybody started to, and was talking about climate as well, Fidel Castro was. So this contradiction of being overly concentrated now, all of these powerful Western neoliberal capitalist forces are going down the rabbit hole of Ukraine. And I think some of them are beginning to say, whoa, wait a minute, how are we going to deal with China, the alliance of China and India and Indonesia and all these countries in the Silk Road and the South-South relations, the revitalization of the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. So I think this is the contradiction that they're facing, and they're trying to leverage now Zelensky that he's got to come to the negotiating table. And what it means at the bottom line is that they're going to have to give up some land. Is that right or wrong? I don't think it's an argument that one can sit around the living room and have. But in terms of real power relationships, this is what it's going to add up. It's not going to be a simple either-or situation. Crimea is not going to be on the table, I think, from the vantage point of the Russians. And the Donetsk area where these Russian-speaking populations are, they're going to have to be able to execute some form of autonomy, perhaps in the context of a Ukrainian state, or they will stay appended to Russia. So that's where I think we are, and I think that's what we're hearing these grumblings about. What has not been dealt with sufficiently, and here it's where public education needs to dig more, there is a fascist element in Ukraine. And what is the role of that element? Is it just a handful of people? Where do they really play? Because this is one of part of the internal contradiction. And finally, I would say that this war is not in the interest of working class people either in the Ukraine or in Russia. And they are the ones who are dying on the battlefield. It is not the political elite. I don't have any book for Putin or the Russian governance system, although I recognize the importance of Putin's policies with Russia in supporting Cuba or how they may be supporting sovereignty in Latin America. But these are the complexities of contradictions, and one has to sort out which contradictions can you live with and which ones are absolutely must be suppressed and defeated.
Yeah, we're going to squeeze in a caller here. Michael, tell us what's on your mind.
Hi. Yes, I agree with much of what you say. But when we talk about the U.S. being a democracy, I want to be clear what we are not. We are a republic. Our founding fathers were very suspicious of democracies and mob rule. That's why we have the Bill of Rights, which is very anti-democratic. It's to protect minorities from majorities. And so I'd like to, you know, make that correction there. And the reason we have a Senate, again, and thing is because the small states were very suspicious of the large states. They didn't want to be ruled specifically by large states to go to that historical context. And so when people always say, well, we are a democracy, we are not, and we were never intended to be a democracy. So I'm happy to, you know, hear your comment.
Well, thanks a lot for calling in, Michael. Hope to hear from you again soon. But, I mean, I got to tell you, as a republic, the U.S. doesn't really work either. Because, I mean, my understanding of a republic is that a situation where power is held by people and they're elected representatives. Well, even if we look at how, you know, Congress plays out, I mean, the largest state in the country and the smallest states in the country may have the same number of representatives and things like that. So it's not actually representative. The representatives don't actually represent the people of their state or where it is that they're from. And of course, we know under capitalism, they don't represent their economic interests either. So this is really the point that we're trying to make. We're not necessarily just talking about electoral processes and things like that. The whole of how this country operates is fundamentally undemocratic and unequal on purpose to protect the interest of the capitalist class and their property. And indeed, it's to protect the capitalist system in itself. And so what is needed then is a real kind of democracy, like we've been discussing the projects that happen in different parts of the Latin America region in different ways, a participatory kind of democracy, a real representative democracy. You know, if representatives really held the power in this country, then we should have the power to recall them and all of these sorts of things, which we don't actually have the ability to do. So I just feel like in just about every way, and, you know, people can quibble about democracy, Republican, things like that. But the real relevant question is, for whom is this society actually designed to benefit? And it isn't the working class here. But it's an important thing to consider, Jackie, when we talk about sort of a bourgeois democracy under a capitalist system and what that looks like under a socialist structure and what that could look like here in the United States. I mean, it would have to be completely unlike how this country has operated over the last several centuries of its existence, in the sense of actually having a say in what happens in their communities, in their lives, how they deal with issues like food and labor and all of these very basic things that we don't have control of. You know what I'm saying? As of this moment here.
I mean, exactly. And to, you know, the caller's point about, you know, we have a Bill of Rights to protect the interests of minorities. Well, when you look at the people who wrote the Bill of Rights and the people who wrote the Constitution and the people who set up this republic, the minorities that they were protecting were not, you know, landless poor people. And it certainly wasn't our ancestors. So we see the legacy of the minority that those people were protecting, which were the small number of wealthy white landowning, mostly slaveholders in this country. These documents existed to protect their power. So because if it were not true, if this republic actually worked, then this idea of minorities being protected under the law, well, we wouldn't have to fight for the rights that we allegedly have under the Constitution, but we do. But this is why we are fighting for a system that allows for the true representation, one person, one vote, and the actual representative democracy that will allow participation of all people in government and the influence that government has on our lives. And this is, I mean, to understand the difference between the two systems, I think, goes very far, far deeper than, you know, quibbling between whether this country is a democracy or a republic. Whatever it is, it doesn't work, Mr. Early.
So So listen, this, first of all, thank you, caller. And you late tonight, I'm to go on my Google and re-examine some of these questions. I think you have helped bring a very important question to the table. And I hope perhaps the next time that I'm on this program that we can look at the question of democracy. I will leave you with a convolution. I was just reading the other day that physicists now believe that there are no laws of physics. There are only mathematical models that help us to understand some things in life that we can do practical things. But the bigger answers are still out there. I think the question of democracy, even bourgeois democracy, works this way. If you are a Jew, a black person, a homosexual, let's say 1920s, 1930s, and you were being lynched, spit on, burned out, pogroms, lynch, etc., and you argued the case of the principles of bourgeois democracy, and you were able to push law enforcement, push the public, not to stop hating you, not to stop despising you, but to stop lynching you, at least at the level of the pogroms against Jews and so forth and so on, that is a sense of the people's power using those principles. And so I think this is a complex matter. It is one, not one of absolutes. It's a living proposition. But I do hope that we could revisit and that the caller who has prompted us to examine these questions would come back on, perhaps maybe be one of the participants, and we can look at this question of democracy under capitalism and the socialism, look at how it has historically evolved. And even under socialism in Cuba, the question of democracy is a question that is still being pushed forward and debated in concrete ways. Not the abstract principles are there, but the practical implications are not so easily elucidated, and they don't just pop up automatically. So I know we probably went out of time, but thank you, caller, for raising that with us, and I think we should revisit this issue.
Absolutely. A worthwhile topic for sure. Well, we thank you so much, Mr. Early, for joining us today. We're going to leave it there for today here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Be back tomorrow with all new episodes. So as always, we'll see you next time. Peace.
By Any Means Necessary.